You know, if business does have a bigger responsibility, and that is up for debate, and if it has the huge opportunity, which I definitely believe that it does, then the more that we talk cross industry, the more that we learn from different industries, the more that we can use business to look at how the NHS works, and learn lessons from that, then I think the more that opportunity will help, not just as individual and leaders, but also in building those businesses. And that's the kind of role for One Question.
Hello and welcome to Minto Dialogue, episode number 351. Today is Sunday, the 1st of December 2019. My name is Minto Dial, and I'm your host for this podcast. And I want to thank you for choosing to take the time out of your busy day for the listen. I also want to give it a shout out and thanks for putting up a review of this show on iTunes to Adrian Swinsko and Topical Todd. This week's interview is with Sarah Parsonage. Sarah was previously Managing Director, Performance Inn, and publisher of The Memo, and she founded and produces One Question, a unique event asking all speakers to tackle just one question. In this interview with Sarah, we discuss the inspiration behind One Question, which was the best one and why, the state of the events industry, how to create great events, what are the big challenges that business executives face that One Question answers, and why to become a member. A passionate conversation. Sarah Parsonage, my goodness, how great to have you on the show. We've known each other for now many years, have hung out over numerous encounters, and finally decided that I had to get you on the show. So, Sarah, you have an illustrious background, really involved in marketing and events, which is something, of course, near to my heart. And you began this thing called the One Question. So in your own words, how would you like to introduce yourself, Sarah?
Thank you. It's nice. It's nice to be asked. One Question is a network that forces change through a series of different content, online, in life, and in print. It challenges the way that you think about your everyday and breaks down certainly industry echo chambers, I think is probably the best way to describe it. I've started it in 2016 in the iteration of events, and we've now grown and scaled into a monthly newsletter, coffee table book, research, and an online video platform.
So how did Sarah Parsonage get into One Question?
Long story short, I think, is that I was formerly MD of a B2B publisher specializing in performance marketing and decided that I didn't want to do that anymore. So I stepped down from that role and in doing so spent a lot of time in other industries doing lots of non-exec stuff, consultancy stuff, and got completely disheartened by the state of the event space, specifically in marketing and advertising. I think it's fair to say that it predominantly become a bit of a cash cow institution in which it was how much can we pay to put a keynote speaker on stage and therefore how much can we pay for people to attend and how many of those people can we get in one space at one time. And it was an echo chamber of, for example, marketing talking to marketers about marketing, which only really served to be validation that you're doing a good job and a pat on the back, or spying on competitors. But the real learnings and the real relationships, and for me specifically, the real change didn't come from those kind of events, and which I think is a real shame, because actually events is fundamental, not only to businesses as part of a wider strategy, but also to ourselves, because I believe that what is very important is that relationships in life will always supersede those that are online. It doesn't matter how much the sort of innovation in technology scales. The real relationships and the ones that are the most sustainable are the ones doing this kind of thing, mm-hmm. As opposed to sort of ones that are conducted solely on Twitter or WhatsApp or whatever. And so I decided that I wanted to change the event space predominantly, but I also wanted to create something that wasn't about echo chambers, because in doing the due diligence in setting up One Question, it became clear that actually the same is very true of finance, of healthcare. And of course, those sort of echo chamber events, as I call them, serve a purpose, because we like to live in our comfort zones, and actually business thrives within those comfort zones based very obviously on who we're buying and selling to and from. But actually the real learnings and the real relationships is that if I was to look through one of my biggest challenges in business through the lens of a different industry, how much would I learn? And that's really where one question came about. I wanted it to be simple. I wanted it to be able to focus on one thing. And I didn't want it to be a marketing event or a health event or a insert industry event. And so I was able to do that by asking one question through the lenses of many different industry perspectives and find out what kind of answers that we got.
So as you say, the issue with events and these echo chambers is not specific to marketing. I wanted to look at the events idea because at some level, what has made the event space so fraught? Not just the fact that people are making these business models or these different types of echo chamber systems, but to what extent do you feel that the digital world disrupted the notion of events or could enhance events?
So I think this is really interesting because I actually don't think that the digital world disrupted an event in the sort of more traditional form of can we run a conference call conference, for example. But what I do think is that a lot of the publishing and a lot of the news content, obviously with the rise of the internet, became free-for-all. It's obviously we're seeing a sort of maybe a change now, but certainly 2010 and before, content was becoming free. It was very difficult to retain any subscriptions. And so big publishers, especially trade publishers, and not just within marketing, but within other industries, were really struggling to retain those subscription numbers. They were falling and fast because people could access this content for free and therefore didn't feel the need to subscribe to that monthly magazine, especially in print. And so the obvious thing for a lot of these huge publishers to do would be able to change that into a real life environment in which they have the content because it's already in that magazine. They have the subscription list of people that will come and see that. And then you have this added value of learning and relationships. And so it became absolutely saturated, which pushed the price up because the event industry is perceived to be this cash cow. But actually events are incredibly expensive to run or can be. And they're very hard to sustain, especially when we're now in our industry, especially we're in the marketing industry. We're seeing such saturation. And so it just became an absolute free-for-all. And I think that's what I found really sad. And certainly it then stopped being about this incredible experience that makes you feel something. And I had this debate a few years ago with a very good friend of mine, where I was arguing that events should make you feel something. And that should stay with you. And he was saying, no, don't be ridiculous. You know, you go to a Salesforce event and it doesn't make you necessarily feel anything. It makes you feel excited at the time. Maybe you learn some stuff, but that feeling fades quite quickly. And I think that's kind of a really good example of where maybe the industry has gone wrong.
So what if you were running a brand, a commercial brand, company selling, you know, Doritos or whatever? What advice would you give them in the idea, because obviously brands are into this idea of community and fans and all this. How would you suggest that they look at orchestrating events as part of their portfolio of activities to garner fans and clients?
Well, first of all, do they need to do an event? It's like anything, right? Any marketing channel. Do you need to be doing this particular thing? And actually, what are the objectives? Because for Doritos, their community is quite big. And so for them to do an event for their community, it would be almost impossible. Well, certainly on if they want to include everybody. So I think it's looking at, is that something they really need to do? And also, why? Why are they wanting to do it? It's like anything. It's like a client of mine saying to me in the marketing days, I want to be on Snapchat. Well, why? Why do you want to be on Snapchat? Because it's new and because it's shiny or because it actually adds value to what your overall objectives are, either marketing or business. So those would be the first two things which I would challenge with. And then I think it would, depending on what those answers are, it would be regional, community-based to achieve those. Mm-hmm. Actually going into the places in which they need to talk to. And arguably, even for a brand like Doritos, that would be really important. But otherwise, it's not going to work.
I don't know why I took Doritos in. But as you were speaking before and talking about these events, naturally make you feel something. Well, great. There's this notion of networking and meeting people. But when you go to some of these conferences that have 50,000, 100,000 people, the chances of you not being able to find somebody interesting are rare, because within 40,000 people, then the onus is on you as an individual to find the person. Yet, you also come across a lot of drab, non-interesting people, or at least not pertinent to your life. And so it's non-curated, and therefore it's a little bit up to luck in order to make the meeting happen that leaves you something which is lasting. Could be, for example, a new friendship that lasts forever.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think one of the things I have to caveat is that I have a very romantic notion of what I'm doing, and I fully admit that. But also, it's something I passionately believe in, because the events that you're talking about obviously serve a purpose. Of course they do. Whether they really shape change or whether they make you feel anything is, I guess, debatable. And also, I think the reaction that you're talking about is perhaps through a relationship of a lifetime friend, whereas a lot of these events exist through a commercial win, so to speak, a way of doing business.
A new customer,
a new lead, and is that lead going to convert? And that's why a lot of companies do these things, and of course that's why they should do these things. But again, it comes back to the same thing that I should get a t-shirt with a written on, you know, quality over quantity, always, for me. And so I guess the type of change that I talk about, and the line about it should make you feel something, and I guess an example of that could be creating a partnership that generates significant ROI. So Bloomberg were one of our partners for this year, 2019 annual event, which asked, does purpose really drive profit? And this is all over the website, so I'm sure Cara won't mind. My contact at Bloomberg. And in our post-event meeting, she described one question as indulgence with ROI. Because it gives you this opportunity in which to have conversations that you wouldn't normally have in a intimate environment through really curated content that will probably generate really good future business relationships, but also makes you as a person feel like you've learned something. It changes how you think about something. And in the first year, 2016, great example, and still quite, makes me quite emotional, but we had how do you successfully marry technology and humanity? So many questions. I think it was one you came to, actually. Mm-hmm. And we had the photographer, Giles Dooley, who now has become very well known. And at the time, he was still doing a lot of his fundraising through some of his third world photography. And he'd been this photographer in fashion, predominantly in music, and changed it to take photos of war victims, and as a result lost some of his limbs. And he did this impassioned session answering the question on how do you successfully marry technology and humanity through the lens of photography. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. It was incredibly moving. It really took everybody's out of their industry, particularly in that moment. Mm-hmm. And a few months later, I had a delegate who got in touch, a guest, who emailed the email address for one question and said, you know, it was such a wonderful event. I don't know what your overall objective is for it, because at this point it was in its first iteration. But I wanted you to know that we've cancelled our family holiday and we're actually going to go and volunteer to help some of these war victims based on what Giles said. Now, that's one example of my belief in which events can shape change. But that manifests itself in so many different ways that you just don't get on a commercially, a lead generation driven 150,000 person conference, because the meetings that you set up generally don't happen. The Wi-Fi kind of doesn't work. The people don't turn up. Everything changes. And that's even if you can find that person. Mm. So one question is completely different to those type of events.
Yes, it did. No, it is beautiful. And in the end of the day, it's more of a conversation somehow. And the statement that the Bloomberg woman said was, which is indulgence with probable ROI. The way I react to that is, first of all, it's indulgence as opposed to sales or some commercialness, which is deeply human. And second of all, the word probable was interesting to me. Because as soon as it becomes too certain, it becomes too formulaic, too unhuman, and not enough messiness. So the probability of that email for Giles coming through, well, you didn't plan on that, but it did happen, and so it's a testament to making things happen. So I wanted to ask you, what you've done now four annual conferences. You've got next one coming next in 2020. Yeah. How do you come up with the one question?
I really wish that there was some incredibly forensic scientific response, but there isn't. There genuinely isn't. So when we asked, has technology enhanced or damaged our experiences? And obviously, as you know, knowing me quite well and having sort of known one question since its beginning, we curate the conference. That is the most important part, that and the network and the community. But the curation is absolutely key to, obviously, it's called One Question, it has to be. And we had a series of different talks throughout that day that focused around mental health and the ability to stop, and actually the ability for us to take more control around the way that we use technology. And it was fascinating because there came out so many different threads from that particular conference and from the different sessions. Rankin, who I interviewed, the photographer and filmmaker, at the end of the day, actually did a call, kind of a call to arms, to say, we need to be able to control how we use technology. And that's really what then feeds the next question. It's the provocation and it's the thinking that comes out of that full day, which, as you can imagine, is vast, mm-hmm. that then starts to shape. And so through a lot of those conversations, I started to think, okay, well, what's fundamental to business? What's absolutely fundamental to business, aside from obviously technology and the innovation there, but also people, right? People are fundamental to business and profit. Because without profit, you can't do a lot, really. You can invest it back into the business.
Money has its role.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it got me thinking to purpose and what actually is a company's purpose nowadays. And also there's a slight, I suppose, mischievous part of me that I did talk about at the conference this year, is that the marketing industry especially has this trend with bastardizing any word. And so purpose became a buzzword. And it's a shame, in the same way that community has, because if you take it back to what it actually means, it means something very different. Mm. And so I was doing a slight play on, does purpose really drive profit? Came from that. But then we twisted it on our head. So, of course, we had Patagonia talking about it from the brand perspective, and actually what's the responsibility of a brand on society? Is there any? And how do they do that? And, of course, Alex Weller, who's marketing director for Europe, said, well, we don't really call it purpose because it's the passion. But we also had a political perspective that actually said, okay, well, arguably in the States it's slightly different financially, but arguably over here it's not about money and winning money. So if you change the definition of profit to votes, then surely politics should be purpose driven throughout. So if you ask that question to politics, what does that look like? If you ask that question to a major in the army, which is what we did, what does that look like? Because we all know that you don't earn an absolute fortune being in the army, and certainly your family doesn't.
Or in politics.
Or in politics, exactly. So there's all these different ways that you can play with this question as soon as you look it through the lens. And I suppose that's how we come up with the next question. Mm. Also, I have an incredibly robust advisory board and board, both of which have played quite a big part in that.
So tell us about the business model, speaking of purpose.
Mm-hmm. So the business model has evolved. I always wanted to start One Question through the form of events, because it goes back to my point of, if I send you an email from One Question, you might read it, maybe, maybe not. It might even not even get to you. But if you've been to a One Question event and you've loved it, then you're going to read that email. Mm-hmm. So I always wanted to start it in events, and we did the very traditional model, as a lot of events do, through sponsorship and ticket sales. And we've evolved now, having done our fourth conference and our second debate. So we've set up a membership. So you can become a member of One Question, which gives you access to the annual event, which is now members only, gives you access to the debating series, all of our research, our video archive, our coffee table books, and lots more to come. And then we have key partners. So we have industry partners that can be involved in the different perspectives. And then we have program partners that can be involved in One Question. And they, through that, we really take the One Question ethos, which is examining big societal and business challenges through the lens of different industries.
Well, that is exactly what my next question was going to be about, which is, how do you describe the core challenges for business, and to what extent and how is One Question the solution?
So this is really interesting, and I don't sort of pertain to have all of the answers, obviously. But I think, I think as we were saying earlier in part of our discussion, and I guess there's a few parts to this answer. Businesses now, for me, have a bigger responsibility than they've ever had before in order to shape change. And when I say before, I mean in my lifetime, and certainly in my working lifetime, which isn't a vast amount of time, but certainly when my dad ran his business, he was able to look at maybe the FT or the different media outlets to shape some of the economical decisions that he would make. And obviously government played a huge part in that. And I think our trust in those two institutions has changed and evolved. I do think that there is an argument to say it's coming full circle again, but certainly through a period of time, we don't use those institutions in the same way to shape those decisions.
So why do you think that business now has more responsibility than it did in the past? What has created that particular change?
I think, to be honest, I think it's come through a lot to do with the internet, technological innovation, the ability to create communities of massive scale. The likes of Facebook that didn't exist when I was a teenager have obviously shaped that change. But I think more importantly for me, and this is probably an entirely different podcast, but they've shaped that they have more influence and they certainly have more power. And we've seen it because, again, that comes through the sort of change in the publishing space.
So I just we're thinking about that. You have the scale of the Facebooks and Googles, but maybe it's also the direct contact with, so the influence, but the direct contact both ways that has rendered, it's no longer a 30-second spot. It's a, because I could communicate out and I could influence through advertising before, scale. But this notion of being direct and two-way has meant that companies have a different relationship with their consumers than in the past. Whereas maybe a councilman or an MP might have gone out in the street and pounded the pavement to get that contact with the locals. But companies didn't do that before because it just wasn't feasible.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also constant. It's always on. You can contact your customer at any time in many different ways. Mm-hmm. And I also think that, ironically, and this is purely opinion, there are a lot of organisations out there that can do that. They can contact their customers really quickly. And the legislation behind that from them and the risk professionally and PR is not doing that. But we had somebody from the Obama campaign speak for us in 2017 on Can You Trust Technology? And the way the White House communicated to its constituencies and to the world back in, I don't know, the early 90s, for example, was very different to how they do now, right? Yeah, sure. But of course, that has to be in some way, shape or form controlled. Mm-hmm. And businesses don't necessarily have that same level of control. They have much more ease to a point, of course. So I think there's lots of reasons why businesses has got more power, and industry has got arguably more power. The rise of Salesforce and the influence, and obviously when you're the sort of the size of Salesforce, and obviously Benioff's just come out and done his book, so we'll see what that actually comes to. Mm-hmm. But
you mean the publishers? And books still have a purpose?
Well, I was talking about more whether his kind of manifesto will actually reap anything. So we'll see. And I'm sort of, I guess, yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that works out. But the point being is that when you have the sort of profit, you can obviously do a huge amount with that. So I think there's that. And there's also this time now where being a CEO is not just about balancing books, counting toilet rolls. It's about having an opinion and more so being able to articulate that opinion, to create a more diverse workforce, to ensure that you're building a sustainable planet for a sustainable business for the planet and for the future generations, to ensure that you are adhering to gender equality, to ensure that you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it goes on and it goes on. And it's arguably one of the hardest jobs, I think, to have. And so I think what one question does in that role is that it asks big questions, but it enables those companies to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. You know, if business does have a bigger responsibility, and that is up for debate, and if it has the huge opportunity, which I definitely believe that it does, then the more that we talk cross industry, the more that we learn from different industries, the more that we can use business to look at how the NHS works and learn lessons from that, then I think the more that opportunity will help, not just as individual and leaders, but also in building those businesses. And that's the kind of role for one question, I think.
It strikes me, Sarah, listening to you about the CEO conundrum. I've written a lot about this notion of introducing politics into the business boardroom. And to what extent should CEOs be latching on to political issues? What you're telling me makes me think that for certain CEOs, coming to a one question or being part of that community will, on the one hand, give permission to look at political issues and also field and benchmark and understand where should I be pushing. The issue at some level is that you can't just be, you know, doing the thing that everybody's doing, because, well, then you there's no sound bite to that. It's just, well, you don't believe that we should have pedophilia? Well, that's not a political statement. That is an obviousness. But coming up with something that stands out, is valid in your community for your business, is yet a very rare thing. And it sounds like your community is more embracing that idea.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And I think it's also about making those decisions now is incredibly difficult. And one question isn't just about CEOs. It's also about giving a platform to voices that don't always get heard through different industries. Yes, it does attract a senior audience, arguably, and it attracts a very curious audience. But also, and I think going back to Cara's point, it gives you the opportunity to learn so much more and look at your business and the issues that you're having, whether it is how do I communicate to a workforce why we actually exist and why is that important to us, if it is. How do I communicate to our shareholders why that is important? How do I actually adhere to building a more sustainable business, and what does that look like through the lens of B Corp, for example? And how do we approach that, and what are they doing in the NHS, and what can one sizable company look at and how what they're going through and what they're struggling through could support what the NHS is going through, and it might be very different. I use Tom's as an example. So Lisa Hogg, marketing director, because she did the marketing perspective, talked for us again on the same purpose and profit question. And they have the one-for-one model. The shoe company that have the one-for-one model. And for them, their purpose, for want of a better word, their giving, as they call it, is a line on the P&L. And so having that insight into actually what purpose is for them was able to give a room from other people, from Unilever to IBM to Sony Music, the idea of actually what that looks like. And you know, then you have somebody from the army, Major Andrew Fox, who was brilliant, and he talks about actually his purpose is to create an environment in which we all feel safe, and it's
which
about
is sort of counterintuitive to what people think about in the army. They popping off heads is what they, you know, people will think about, but that is a much more pacific and noble cause.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like anything, you can look at it in two different ways, right? There are cynical ways of looking at it. There are more optimistic and positive ways of looking at it. And that's the point of the question. And as I said to you earlier, our question next year, how can business make society better, automatically asks, well, does society need to be better? What does better look like? How do we define better? And is it the role of business to do that?
Of the four questions you've done, maybe the fifth to come, do you have a favorite so far?
Question?
Yeah.
Ooh. I think I have favorite perspectives and favorite speakers mm-hmm. to specific questions. Mm-hmm. I love all the questions. I really loved this year. Because I think it was our first move away from using a technology-based question, which was really important to me. And I loved the idea. I loved the different perspectives of how we answer that. So I think this year's question was one of my favorite. I actually think next year's is maybe one of our best.
Well, inevitably, I think the context within which these questions come favors and slants which question is the best, because there's a contemporaneous to each question, and that's the feeling I get having observed how you've grown. So how do you measure success? And let's say in 5-10 years, where is one question?
It's a great question, ironically. And I think success means different things for different people, and certainly does for me. I want one question to build and grow and actually facilitate conversations that can shape change within different industries, especially. And that will take time for sure. But I think that's what success looks like for me, to build a community of people that can shape change within their own environments through conversations that we've started and created, and continued conversation, which is obviously what we're working on at the moment. And to stand by what I said at the beginning, which is one question is designed to challenge the way that you think about your everyday. And if you go through life with that that call to action, so to speak, it really changes. It does change the way that you think. So I think that. And then for me, there is a very personal bit of success, which means at some point Italy will be a key on the horizon, I think, for me personally. But yeah, I would like to take one question into the US, which is our plan certainly for 2020. I would like to expand it into Asia and be able to ask that question from different cultures and different businesses, and then bring it all together. Again, with this overall view to shape change, and also take it regionally within the UK to start with, for example. So
for people who are listening, who is the ideal one questionee, or whatever you want to call the ideal candidate to join your community?
I think it does range, because there's a wealth of people who are naturally very curious and who want a reason to get out of bed in the morning that is more than just maybe their job. And there's some people that that thrive on routine, and learning outside of that routine is really exciting, but maybe they're not naturally that way. So I think there is different people. I think overall, one question, people that love one question and are committed to it and invested in it and see the real value behind it and what it can do, are curious. They are natural thinkers and changers. And I think we do attract a relatively a senior audience, because one question, it's very intimate. It is obviously members only. There are no slides. So all of the sessions are either interview form or individual presentations. And there's a natural request or ask to be very engaged. And I think as a result of that, it attracts maybe a senior audience. There is a very obvious commercial benefit to anybody in the room and to any partners involved, but the aggressive lead generation element to it is not something that exists. So I think if that is your sole purpose, then it's one question probably isn't the community or event for you. I think it's probably a fair way. But it's hard, because we all talk about people. It is one question, is you get it or you don't.
The way I describe it, or I would describe it, Sarah, is people are interested in doing good with business. That is to say, using business as a conduit for good. That's the way I describe it. Clearly, it's the question for 2020. how can people follow you, Sarah, get in touch, and of course, sign up for One Question?
So everything about One Question is on our website, onequestion.live. I'm on Twitter predominantly. I tend not to use any other form of social. I'm not very good at LinkedIn. Or email us at onequestion.live, or email me. I mean, there's lots of different ways. We have our own Twitter, _onequestion. So I think those are all the different ways to find out. We've got massive, massive plans for next year, which is equally as exciting as it is daunting. So now's a good time to get involved.
Beautiful. Congratulations, Sarah. A wonderful project. And I think you're on to a lovely success. And I love the model, and I love the vibe and the energy that you bring to it. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minter Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes and other blog posts on MinterDial.com. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to iTunes to give a rating and review. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man. Still, I won't tell the lie.
kissing me lying. I'm a convinced man building an urge. I'm a convinced man to live and die sober. A convinced man in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man in the arms of a woman. Despise revenges and struggle to see. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man.
World's best-known investor and Wall Street expert Warren Buffett once said, "Wall Street is the only place that people ride to in a Rolls Royce to get advice from those who take the subway." Mr. Buffett's quote is remarkably accurate, but how many people would rather receive advice from him than someone simply guessing? Welcome to Buy, Hold, Sell, your single source for Wall Street knowledge and profitable guidance. Please join me, Todd Schoenberger, and fellow trader Tobin Smith, as well as host Veronica Dudo, for a podcast known to move the needle for investors. Tobin and I are seasoned Wall Street executives with deep investment experience, and we are prepared to share our advice to those who choose to listen. Download Buy, Hold, Sell today on the Evergreen Podcast Network or your favorite podcast channel.